from the elections in Alabama to a Christian perspective on feminism, all coming your way today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
There's a whole lot to talk about, to process. Immediately after the results were in and the election was called for Democrat Doug Jones in Alabama last night, I put some thoughts out on a video immediately and then actually wrote two articles. We'll be getting into some of the content of that shortly. But as always, we want to come from a gospel perspective as we look at what's happening in the world around us. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. And today, the first half hour, we're going to focus on the Alabama elections and try to ask some larger questions and get a divine perspective if we can, or at least questions that will help us to respond in a gospel-based way. We'll be doing that if you'd like to call in, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. But I want to start off with something a little different. I've been listening to, reading as much news coverage as I could follow since the race was called last night for Democrat Doug Jones in Alabama. And I haven't seen this angle talked about much, but it's got me wondering. And after I wrote my first article about this issue last night, I thought, you know, let me write a separate article addressing this. Here's my question. Did Matt Drudge and the highly conservative Drudge Report website, which gets some months well over 1 billion page views, it is a news aggregator. It just puts headlines up on a page, just stark headlines, and obviously reports on what it thinks is important and obviously influences people in that way, is strongly, strongly pro-Trump, pro-conservative, and yet hotly opposed Judge Roy Moore. Why? Well, it's because there appears to be a personal issue between Matt Drudge of the Drudge Report and Steve Bannon of Breitbart. I want you to just look at some of the recent headlines that were on Drudge Report. For example, on election day, just take a look at some of these headlines. Judge does interview with 12-year-old girl, shows up to vote on horseback, friend gives brothel defense, Moore's last push, it's me or the lynch mob media. Scarborough hits back at Bannon. Nation watches on eve of toxic election, unlikely nail-biter drama nears explosive end, Judgment Day. Okay, so most of those disparaging headlines about Judge Moore. And now the main headline on the page, look at this. It's got Judge Moore riding on horseback, and then it says Brokeback Election. Brokeback. Are you harking back to Brokeback Mountain with the infamous movie about two gay lovers, gay cowboy? What? Brokeback Election? And then when it was called for Democrat Doug Jones, remember, he is a staunch liberal. Drudge Report is staunchly conservative. The main headlines that ran, and for those watching on YouTube, we're putting this on the screen now. Those that will watch later on video, you can see this. Look at what the main headline ran. Dem wins Alabama, White House shell shock, and then Bannon busted. This is the major headline on Drudge, Bannon busted, because Steve Bannon made it his personal cause to see Roy Moore elected and basically guaranteed President Trump he's going to get in, endorse him. That's what we understand. So Drudge Report's read by a lot of people. Roy Moore loses by, what, 20,500 votes, 20,500 roughly. I wonder if Drudge Report discouraged enough conservatives in Alabama, they weren't sure what they were going to do, and all the negative headlines gave them the further incentive, forget it, we're just not going to vote. Could it be that Matt Drudge negatively influenced the elections against Roy Moore? Just another piece of the puzzle. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the day after the special election in Alabama. And shocking on the one hand that a liberal Democrat won in very conservative Alabama. Not shocking when you realize everything that was up against Roy Moore. So not just the fact that you had the Republican establishment coming against him, and then the Democratic establishment coming against him, and even President Obama putting out a call to counter the call from President Trump. Trump saying vote for Moore, Obama saying vote for Jones. But not just that, the big issue, the sexual allegations, the sexual charges. Now, I've said this repeatedly. If I believed he was guilty, I could not vote for him in good conscience. You say, but it was 40 years ago. God can forgive. I agree with all that. All of us are forgiven of something on some level, right? On a daily basis, God forgives us. Certainly, many of us have histories that are anything but savory, and God's forgiven us of those things. But here's the difference, and I want to point this out again. I saw an article I was alerted to on Friendly Atheist attacking me once more for my position on Judge Moore. And I say attack me once more. We get attacked there with some regularity, which is fine as long as they're reading our stuff and watching videos. That's great. But they seem to miss my point that I said if I believed he was guilty, I would not and could not vote for him. You say, yeah, but look, there's been no pattern of that for decades. All the accusations are so old. I understand. But if he was guilty, then he's lying about it today. That was my issue. In other words, if I thought he was guilty, I wouldn't and couldn't vote for him. Why? Because he was guilty then and is lying about it today, which means he's guilty today. And when you are a Ten Commandments person, when you're known as a Bible-based Ten Commandments committed conservative Christian, and you are a lying hypocrite, I'm not saying he is. God forbid that I make that accusation. But if he was guilty then he is a lying hypocrite today. Not only so, the women that he would have abused or been guilty of having misconduct with, the teenagers, these young women, right? If he was guilty of that and they're coming forward and saying it, and now he's denying it, he's further sinning against them. You say, yeah, but hang on. We're talking about saving baby lives. I understand that, but I am not going to vote for someone that I know to be a hypocritical liar claiming to be a Christian. It's one thing voting for President Trump, going to get what we expect to get, meaning I'm not expecting him to be Christian, praying that he will be, but not expecting him to be, and knowing it's going to be a mixed bag. When it would come to Roy Moore, I'd be voting for him because he's a conservative Christian. And yet if he was lying, I couldn't vote for him. Now, because I didn't know if the charges against him are true. And it's wild. I hear from people every day, all day long, that say, how can anyone think he's guilty? How can anyone for a split second think that he's guilty? He's so clearly not guilty. These are false allegations. And I'm looking over at YouTube, a comment from Kristen. Get ready. The Democrats will throw sexual allegations at every Republican from now on. They found a working tactic now. Well, if that was the case, that's true. You can falsely accuse anybody, and then once they're tarnished, everyone has to run from them. But if I wasn't sure, and that's the case, I read every day people saying, of course he's guilty, it's clear, and he did a lousy job of denying it, changed his stories, and on and on and on. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, people say, how do you possibly think he's guilty? So my final conclusion was, I don't know. And therefore, if I was planning to vote for him, I would vote for him with the expectation, not that a court would take him to trial or that he'd be held before an earthly judge, but a Senate Ethics Committee would be forced to investigate. And he'd have to swear under oath, and the people testifying against him would have to swear under oath. And I would believe that we would get to the truth in that case, and that either he would be vindicated and exonerated, or he would be found guilty, in which case he'd have to step aside. Then we'd have another proper election, and when that hopefully we could just vote on the issues and not have to deal with the allegations. So that was my position. but it's a very difficult decision for people to make. And even so, the election ended up being very, very close. If Judge Moore had done a better job of handling the accusations and how he responded, perhaps that would have made the difference. If the Republican establishment hadn't been against him, could that have made the difference? A little bit more advertising funding and backing? Were people voting against President Trump? And this is a backlash against him with his low approval ratings. Conversely, did his endorsement help? These are questions that others will sort out. But let me refer to an article that David French wrote, attorney, conservative columnist. He was in the Never Trump camp. I agree with so much of what he writes, differ here and there, but so appreciate his writing. On the National Review in the corner, he has an article, Alabama Conservatives Made Their Stand. And let me read the beginning of his article. Let's plainly state the reason why Roy Moore lost tonight. Alabama conservatives took a stand. By the tens of thousands, they either stayed home, voted for other candidates, or, in some instances, voted for Doug Jones. To say that conservatives beat Roy Moore is not to take one thing away from Doug Jones. He ran a smart race, he mobilized Democrats, and his voters came to the polls in large numbers, large enough to win. But this is Alabama. He could have run the perfect race, and he still would have lost if conservatives supported their party's nominee. Very true. In other words, when the votes started coming in, even though Roy Moore was ahead, the projections were that he could well end up losing by a few points. Why? Because in the areas where he expected massive support, massive conservative Christian support, he ended up getting less support than expected. Just a little increase there would have made a massive difference in the voting, and he easily would have won. That turnout wasn't there. Now, the question is that a good thing or a bad thing? For David French, it's highly commendable. Now, if someone ended up voting for Doug Jones, a conservative ended up voting for Doug Jones instead of Roy Moore, I'd say that's ridiculous because he is a strong liberal candidate. He is a strong pro-abortion candidate, and you don't, in conscience, vote for someone when you're going to vote for a pro-life candidate. You think there's scandals associated with that person, then just vote for someone else or don't vote. But don't throw a vote in the opposite direction. But David French thinks it's highly commendable. His wife has written on this as well, with sensitivity to women who've been abused. And they've said, good work, Christians, conservatives in Alabama. You did the right thing. You showed integrity. You didn't vote. Unless the whole thing is a hit piece. Unless this is a political hit job against a good man. Otherwise, yes, I would say they did the honorable thing. Now, Cal Thomas has an article published in a number of different websites. And Cal Thomas has an article, Roy Moore, God, and the Choices Evangelicals Must Make. This was immediately before the election. And he says this at the end of his article, talking about the chief priests and others who gave Judas money to betray Jesus. As then, today's chief priests and church members are being asked to make a choice. One choice might give short-term satisfaction, as Esau experienced with his temporarily filled stomach, but it leads to a loss of credibility in the eyes of the world that demonstrates that for Christians, attaining earthly and temporal power is paramount. Yes, Cal Thomas, who used to be part of the religious right and then really pulled away from that over a period of time, he's still a strong conservative and a strong conservative voice, but really questioned a lot of what the religious right is doing. That reflects his thinking, but I respect that as well. In other words, were we saying, I don't care if he's guilty or not, I don't care if the charges are true or not, I don't care if he's lying through his teeth or not, we need a Republican majority, we need another pro-life senator in there to get the president's agenda accomplished, and therefore we'll vote for him. He's saying, you do that, you're like Esau. You're selling your birthright just for a little porridge now because you're hungry. You're not thinking long term. And he's saying, if we voted like this, we would thereby sacrifice our integrity. So maybe we get the extra senatorial seat right now, but it will cause more repulsion towards our position as believers, less respect for our integrity, more and more people thinking that we're just compromised, we'll vote for anybody, we don't care about ethics anymore. I think that's an excellent point as well, unless the charges against Roy Moore were false. You have to realize many fine people voted for him because they didn't believe the charges were true. And if they believed the charges were true, they wouldn't have voted. Nonetheless, this is where we stand. Nonetheless, there has been much prayer for this. Now, the question is, moving forward, how do we deal with this? How do we address this? We come back. I want to raise five questions for you of great importance for evangelicals in the aftermath of the Alabama elections. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, I want to do something really cool. If you have a cell phone, if you've got an Android, not if you're driving in your car, don't do it right now, all right, unless you can pull over for a second. But if you've got an Android phone, so Samsung or one of the many Android phones, if you have the Ask Dr. Brown app, here's what I want you to do. I'm gonna grab this on my phone right now. Okay, Ask Dr. Brown. Click on the app. All right, we may not know that you can do this. All right, if you don't have the app, just go to the Play Store, Android, Google Play Store, and just type in Ask Dr. Brown, one word, A-S-K-D-R Brown, and download the app. You'll see it's got latest articles, videos, books, all kinds of our Jewish website. It's really cool. All right, so now I'm gonna click on boom the Line of Fire. Okay. I click on the Line of Fire, and it says podcast, so all the recent shows right there for you, or listen live, or call in. You don't even have to dial the number. Just boom, call in, or watch live. I'm going to click on watch live, and let's see what comes up here. Oh, look at this. As I'm talking about it, there it is on the screen. So this is really, really cool. Now, we're doing our best to get this on Apple. We don't have it on Apple yet, but what you can do on Apple is download the Line of Fire app, and that gives you all kinds of extra benefits as well to listen to the show and catch up with articles, etc. All right, so lots of discussion. Is this a vote against Donald Trump? What does this foretell for the 2018 midterm elections? All kinds of other things. What message is being sent out through this? I want to step back and address this from a little different perspective. And I wrote this article last night after word came in about Doug Jones being declared the victor. I wanted to see Roy Moore win with the hope that he was not guilty of the charges coming against him, and with the hope that with his strong conservative Christian convictions, he could function as a good senator, although I understand that certain statements he's made are not the best statements on other issues in our past. I understand all that. And even when he talked about when America was great, we had slavery, it was bad, but we were great then. What I thought he was saying was there are a lot of great things in our country then. Of course, we had the horror of slavery, which is terrible. But yeah, there were great things in America during that time, and not all of America had slavery, but we had the terrible blight, the horrific, inexcusable blight of slavery. I didn't think he was minimizing that, but either way, statements like that, yeah, I wish he would have said things differently, obviously. But I wanted to step back and say, okay, he didn't get in, and we prayed, and it may not be the outcome some of us wanted. And again, I don't know if he's guilty or not. If he's guilty, I didn't want him in. All right, so here we are. How do we respond? I wrote an article last night entitled Five Questions for Evangelicals in the Aftermath of Roy Moore's Defeat. Five questions for evangelicals in the aftermath of Roy Moore's defeat. I want to share those five questions with you now. Number one, were we guilty of putting our trust in the Republican Party? We got to keep the Senate strong. Okay, we've got to, if it goes this way, now we only have a majority of 51-49. Do you actually think the Republican Party is going to be God's agent of change to bring about moral and cultural reformation in America? Oh, yes. By and large, Republicans are on the good side of pro-life issues and religious liberty issues and standing with Israel issues and national security, and those things are all important to me. But just think of political establishment. That reminds you, you cannot put your trust in the party. And one of the great failures of the moral majority, and James Robinson's been on the air many a time to say this with me, was that it made itself an appendage of the Republican Party. There are white evangelicals still looking to the Republican Party to bring about change. Black evangelicals looking to the Democrat Party to bring about change. And we cannot put our trust in a political party to bring about change. Yes, we're involved in politics. Yes, whether you're independent, Republican, Democrat, go where God calls you and get involved as he calls you to be. But we cannot put our trust in the party to bring about change. That's number one. So were we guilty of putting our trust in the Republican Party? Question number two. Number two, do we pray for the elections more than for awakening? Come on, this is a serious question that we need to ask. Do we pray for the elections more than for awakening? What's more important, who gets elected or the church coming alive through awakening? What's going to have a greater long-term effect on a nation? Yes, who's in the Supreme Court's important. Yes, who's the president's important. Yes, who's in Congress is important. But far more important is awakening, because that's going to change everything from the bottom up to the top and back down. If we only gave ourselves to prayer, fervent prayer, the way we give ourselves to talking about the elections and getting involved in the elections and even praying for the elections, I believe America could be shaken. Question number three, were we willing to trade our integrity for a seat in Congress? Were we willing to trade our integrity for a seat in Congress? In other words, if you said, yeah, I think Roy Moore is guilty of the charges, and yeah, he's lying about it now, but we've got to get somebody in there to stop the liberals and stop the baby killing. You don't find that problematic? Again, we don't know if he's guilty or not. But you don't find it problematic that you would say, yeah, I know the guy is a lying hypocrite. He claims to be a committed Christian, but he's lying through his teeth. He's defaming the women that he sinned against years ago. Doesn't matter. You could vote for that person with integrity of heart. Again, I see this very different voting for President Trump. When they came up with that horrific tape of his, that audio tape of his from 10 years ago, those ridiculous, crude, ugly, inexcusable, despicable comments about women. All right. When he did that and people were mortified, that's who I thought the guy was back then. And hopefully taking some forward steps now. But that's who I thought he was. It didn't surprise me at all. My hope was that God was working in his heart and that he was taking forward steps and that somehow God was using this unsaved man to be a friend of the church and to help in certain key ways. But to this day, his weaknesses are glaring and cause problems. That's very different than someone lying through their teeth claiming to be a born-again Christian and being an outright hypocrite. I couldn't vote for that person in conscience. Again, we don't know that that's the case, but some said, I don't care, I vote for him anyway. That raises questions of integrity in me. Question number four, if our greatest weapons are spiritual, why aren't we using them? If our greatest weapons are spiritual, why aren't we using them? Why aren't we giving ourselves to prayer, fasting, evangelism, reaching the lost? Isn't that going to have a greater impact on our culture? The church winning the lost and seeing a massive harvest of souls, isn't that going to have a greater impact on our culture than whoever's elected to Congress? And then question number five, are we willing to trust the Lord regardless of the outcome of the election? I know there are questions of God's sovereignty. He sets up and removes kings. Well, that's kings because people can't vote. When you vote, he just lets you vote and you get what you deserve. Well, ultimately, we pray and we ask God to work and we have to trust God with the results, whether they are blessing or whether they are judgment. But the key thing is, we must put our trust in the living God, that if Roy Moore was shafted and a good man was taken out, God will ultimately turn it around for good. And if we made some mistakes along the way, God will teach us and turn that for good. We're shifting subjects. Very important discussion about feminism and the Christian when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire. For all of you just tuning in, we have a special treat for you, and I will tell you about that in a moment. Last night, after Doug Jones was declared the winner of the elections in Alabama, I immediately put out a video commentary with some spiritual reflections. Then I wrote an article on five questions for evangelicals after the Alabama elections. And then I wrote another article asking if Matt Drudge of Drudge Report helped take the election away from Roy Moore. Everything is up online or over at the stream, so you can watch on Facebook my video commentary. You can read on the Ask Dr. Brown website or on the stream. You can read my articles. And we've just been talking about this the last half hour, roughly, so you can catch the earlier part of the broadcast. But we are shifting themes now. For some weeks, I've wanted to get a radio colleague on the air with me, Julie Royce. She's written a brand new book, Redeeming the Feminine Soul. Redeeming the Feminine Soul, God's Surprising Vision for Womanhood. I first connected with Julie and her husband in 1993 when they invited me to debate an Orthodox rabbi in Chicago. And to my shock, the debate actually happened. And how that happened, that's a whole other story. But we've been in touch with different ministry things over the years. And she hosts a terrific Saturday broadcast on the Moody Network. It's carried by 145 stations or more, called Up for Debate. I've been on it several times, where you have really lively, intelligent debates about different theological areas of real division. So it's been a joy to be on Julie's show a bunch of times. And the timing of this is just right, because Merriam-Webster, every year they say, here's the word of the year. It could be some new word that's coined or the word that's, you know, come back and to play in a major way. Well, the word of the year for Merriam-Webster was feminism. Feminism. So I want to go over to Julie now. And Johnny, I just need you to connect us there. I'm not able to access my computer. If you could put Julie on the air now, that would be great. But Julie, it's great to have you as a guest on my show.
I know, we're kind of reversing roles. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, the only thing is you don't get to debate anybody. But maybe I'll play the devil's advocate here and
okay.
there.
Okay.
So we've just got a short segment now, but just take a minute or two to explain why you felt you were the right person to write a book on this subject.
Well, for me, a lot of Redeeming the Feminine Soul is my own personal journey to embracing womanhood, because I really struggle with it in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of Christian women do, because we have in a lot of churches two visions of womanhood, and neither mm-hmm. one of them, I think, are particularly attractive to women. You have, you know, sort of your traditional fundamentalist vision of womanhood. And I think a lot of women feel like that denies some of their basic humanity, because it doesn't take into account their gifting and their the ways that perhaps they don't fit that sort of hyper-feminine caricature that they sometimes feel that those churches place them in. And so I feel mm-hmm. there's a lot of chafing against that in a lot of churches, but I know what that's like too, because I've been on staff at churches and felt like, because I'm a woman, that the opportunities are not there, and that I'm not receiving the same training, and really, doors are being slammed in my face just because of my gender. So I understand that struggle. Yet on the other hand, and it's funny that you say that feminism, I read that this morning, it being the word of the year. And mm-hmm. we have a lot of feminist churches. And they, you know, on the other hand, have this vision of womanhood where male and female are really interchangeable. Like women yeah. can do whatever men can do whatever women can do. And I knew, even when I was in my 20s, and I actually leaned more feminist at that time. I've kind of come full circle. But uh-huh. at that point in my life, I still knew that that was
still knew there was there was a difference. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tell you what, we're just gonna jump in. We'll take a quick break here. We'll be right back with Julie Royce, her new book, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, God's Surprising Vision for Womanhood, with a foreword by Kay Arthur. We'll be right back.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us. We're taking a break from talking about Alabama elections and President Trump and Roy Moore and Doug Jones and all of that. We've got a lot of commentary and video and article form from last night until this morning. But we are talking about God's view of womanhood and God's view of feminism. Is feminism always a wrong, demonic, ugly thing? Is there something positive that we can associate with feminism? Is there a way to redeem it? Julie Royce, my guest, has written the book, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, God's Surprising Vision for Womanhood. And if you've never listened to Up for Debate, it's really, really well done. The Up for Debate show that Julie hosts on Moody Radio. And not only do they have guests, good guests, taking up different issues, but they interview a lot of people in advance, and you get lots of really neat perspectives on issues. So if you've never listened to that, just check it out on Moody Radio. Julie, when you hear the word feminism, what comes to mind first when you hear that word?
Misogyny. Which I know a lot of people say, well, how can you say that? Because feminism is supposedly fighting misogyny in our culture. But I think that's because we think of misogyny, really, to bring it to Roy Moore, which we've been talking a lot about today, apparently,
yeah.
That we think of misogyny, literally it means hatred of women, and we think of it in sort of the abuse and harassment, exploitation of women, and that's real overt misogyny. But there's a kind of self-misogyny that I talk about in my book, and this is not just the hatred of women, but the hatred of the feminine. And I see this just rampant in feminism today, because what did Gloria Steinem so proudly proclaim, you know, about three decades ago? She said, we're becoming the men we wanted to marry. In other words, I guess women believe that being men is better than being women, that we actually have a bias against our own gender, that we don't value anymore what we uniquely bring to the table. And I see that as a tragedy, an absolute tragedy. And it's interesting, even with when you saw all of this sex abuse scandal and everything come out, it's reminiscent of what happened with Bill Clinton, isn't it? And yet at that time, who were the people that threw the women under the bus? It was Gloria Steinem, right?
Yeah,
it was, saying, hey, it doesn't matter. Or even Betty Friedan, you know, who launched the second wave feminist movement. She said, you know, I don't care what Bill Clinton did. He's supporting abortion. Talk about a misogynistic thing. Actually encouraging women to kill their own progeny. I can't think of anything more misogynistic than that, if that's been a part of feminism. And it's the reason Betty Friedan said we should support Bill Clinton, even though he's abused women. I mean, these are the sorts of things where feminism, to me, has betrayed women. And to me, the fact that it even has our, you know, feminism, feminine, anything in the name, is an affront to me as a woman, because it has so fundamentally betrayed who we are and what we stand for and what God designed us to be.
Yeah. Now, I want to get into the positive and explore that in a moment. But again, Merriam-Webster says the word of the year is feminism. Feminism beats complicit to be Merriam-Webster's word of the year. Defined as the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes, feminism spiked in online searches after the Global Women's March and revelations about Harvey Weinstein. All right. Obviously, the more that we can point to inequality, mistreatment, abuse, the more we highlight those things, the better. But in your judgment, since the rise of the feminist movement, are women happier and more content today?
Well, studies say we're not. In fact, there's one study that has been following women for like the past five decades. In the 70s, we actually reported that we were happier than men. And over the past few decades, it's actually switched, where now men report that they're happier than women, which, if the feminist movement, if it had a true solution to the problem of women's oppression in the world, if that was the true solution, you would think, Michael, with the success of feminism in so many ways in our culture, that we would be happier. But we're not happier. And the truth is, there was actually a book that was published a while back. It's called Jesus Feminism, almost cloaking feminism in saying that as believers, we can embrace this thing. And the subtitle of the book is, it's the radical notion that women are people too. And that, to me, is so disingenuous, because that is not at all what feminism is about. And I'm glad that the new definition kind of takes that into account. It's an ideology. Yeah. And it's an ism. You know, you can't ignore that. It's not just about women wanting to be treated equal than men. It really is an ideology that's steeped in some fundamentally anti-Christian ideas.
And we'll explore them as well. But let's talk personally. The new book by Julie Royce, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, God's Surprising Vision for Womanhood. So we will, before this interview is over, explore some of the surprising vision. Obviously, folks have to read to get the rest. But you went through a personal crisis in your own life, almost destroyed your marriage. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, something I never would have expected that I'd encounter. But I was in ministry and just caring for people like you do in ministry, right? And found myself in this extremely codependent relationship that I didn't even know what codependency was at the time. Now I understand that it is sort of a dependency on someone being dependent on you and getting your needs. You know, you have these unmet needs and you try to meet them dysfunctionally through caring for somebody else. And it's an awful situation. And I didn't even know how I got there. As I began the healing process after I broke off this relationship, which was incredibly difficult to do. But after I did that and I began through the healing process, I began to understand that I had some deficits from my childhood because my mother had placed my siblings in boarding school because they were missionaries and had kind of emotionally cut off from us kids. And it created the situation where I was susceptible to codependency. But here's the thing that really kind of floored me. Feminists don't know what to make of codependency, because 85% of the literature, codependent literature, is bought by women. It's a predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly female dysfunction. And so, you know, today's society can't figure out why that is, because they say there's nothing essential about being woman or male. They say it must just be that women are somehow conditioned to be that way. But I knew that I wasn't conditioned to be codependent. In fact, I was brought up to be fiercely independent. And yet I fell into this uniquely feminine dysfunction. And it made me suspect at that point, Michael, that maybe my femininity isn't just something that stands on the external of my body. Maybe it's something that's actually woven into my soul, and that I am essentially different than a man in my soul. And that was something where that was a new idea for me, because, again, at this point in my life, I'm in my early 30s. I lean feminist. And so I'm wondering, what is this about? But it really rocked my world, but maybe tilled the soil for God to begin to plant something new and teach me a little bit about what it really means to be a woman.
All right. So why then did God make us male and female? Is it only a matter of procreation? Is it simply a matter of you need a male and a female to produce a child and to raise a child? Is that it? Or is there more to it?
Well, and that was my question as I was in this search. Why is it that God did this? And it really wasn't until I was 40 years old, which I grew up in the church my whole life, and I'd never heard this before. But I began reading something called Theology of the Body, and it's really just a compilation of sermons by John Paul II, which I'm not Catholic. I have some real problems with Catholic theology, and so I wondered, you know, is this okay? You know, I mean, as a Protestant, do we consider what he's writing about orthodox? And I remember going to some professors at Moody and them saying, oh yeah, it's good Trinitarian theology. But this is what I learned. In Genesis 1:27, it says, in his image, he created us, male and female, he created us. So there's something about male and female that reflects the image of God. Well, what is that? Well, then you go to Genesis 2:24, that the two become one flesh. And I learned that that union of male and female, two separate persons, different persons, becoming one flesh, is actually been considered by theologians as a Trinitarian symbol of God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three different persons existing as one essence. And then you skip forward to Ephesians 5, and you see that this one flesh union again is referenced, but this time it says that it's a mystery revealing Christ's relationship with his church. And so I began to see that male and female, marriage, this one flesh union, actually had sort of a sacramental purpose in that it revealed these mysteries of God, these deep spiritual realities, and that Scripture begins in Genesis with a wedding. It ends in Revelation with a wedding feast, and that marriage really is the grand metaphor of Scripture. It's sort of the key to interpreting everything in between. And so, Michael, I began to realize, why is it under attack today? Well, of course it's under attack, because Satan knows if he can destroy our understanding of male and female and of the union of husband and wife, that we will have trouble not just apprehending God himself, but also how God relates to us as his bride. And so then I began to understand I'm living into a much greater reality as a woman when I embrace my design than just, you know, little things.
All right, a lot to unpack here. Friends, the new book, Julie Royce, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, God's Surprising Vision for Womanhood. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, just want to mention, if you're tuning in now, you missed other parts of the broadcast, I've got a short video commentary with thoughts, constructive thoughts after the Alabama elections. You can watch that on the Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page. We also have a link there, my article on 5 questions for evangelicals to ask in the aftermath of elections, and another article that we'll post later. Asking another question, the influence that Matt Drudge and Drudge Report may have had negatively on Roy Moore, just perspective I don't hear a lot talking about. But my focus now, speaking with Julie Royce, her new book, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, God's Surprising Vision for Womanhood. Julie, what about marriage and motherhood? Do women need to find a passion outside of that? Should everything be found within marriage and motherhood? How do you sort that out?
Well, it's interesting, and I tell this story in the book of how I went to a conference and a woman was speaking, and her whole talk was about her mother and how her mother devoted her life to raising children, and then here she got to middle age, and she realized that she didn't know who she was, she didn't know what her purpose was, what her gift was. She had lost herself somehow in raising children, and so she began going to a counselor and going overseas and beginning getting involved in activism and all these different things. And she found, this was her epiphany throughout this whole process, was that she was much more alive when she was doing all this activism than she was doing the jobs of being a mother. So kind of the take home was, yes, if you're a mother, do those things, but you need to find fulfillment outside of those things, you know? So find those things that really fulfill you and that you have a passion for and pursue those. And I was sitting there listening to this, and I was actually just horrified by it, because I'm thinking, one, I mean, at this stage, I have 2 kids out of the house and 1 still at home, but I understand and I remember back when my kids were little, and if somebody told me I have to do something in addition to what I was already doing, it's a pretty all-consuming job raising children, especially when they're young. And besides that, I thought, why are we encouraging women to have their passions met outside of the home? What is that about? And so I remember talking to this one woman who was a stay-at-home mom, and I asked her what she thought, and she kind of hemmed and hawed, but then she asked me, what do you think about that? And I was just like, you know what? My kids, 2 of them are out of the house, there's 1 still here, and I can honestly tell you, I also have this radio job and writing career and speaking. That pales in comparison to how my kids are doing. You get 1 shot at raising your kids, 1 shot. And when it's done, there's nothing else that really matters much more to you than how you did with that job. Do it right. Give yourself to it. And really, Michael, I hear so much of this from women speakers, you know, that you have to find your passion and your fulfillment. And to me, it kind of sounds like Abraham Maslow's, his whole, you know, self-actualization, that that's what life is about. But Jesus says that we find our life by losing it. It's like a total reversal, that we don't have to seek our passions. We seek our purpose in Christ. And we sacrifice ourselves for others. And through that, we become the people God intended us to be. And we fulfill his purpose. But it's about his purpose. It's not about our passions. And so I really encourage women, find your purpose, fulfill that purpose, find your calling in God. And, you know, your passions often follow your purpose, you know. And when you understand your purpose in raising children, these eternal souls, somehow you become pretty passionate about it. And you fall in love with those kids. And if that's your stage in life, give yourself fully to it. It doesn't mean that you can't do anything outside of it, but it does mean they get number one, they get first, those children. And then, you know, as God permits and as time is there. But I really think it's a destructive message to women today, telling them that they have to find something other than motherhood to be fulfilled.
What about single women? What about women that at this stage in their life, either by divine calling that they're embracing or just where they find themselves, they're single? What would you say to them in terms of finding a sense of purpose and identity? Maybe they know God's calling them to be married, but it's not time yet, or maybe they don't feel that they're called to be married at all. What would you say to those women?
You know, some of the women that I would say have mothered in a spiritual sense, more children than any woman I know are single women. Mm. I have seen them mentor, do exactly what Scripture says about the older women discipling the younger women, have done that on such a larger scale than I could ever do because I have biological children and they take a lot of my time. But I've seen my friend who's, she's a professor, a youth ministry professor at a Christian university. My guess is she has dozens, maybe even, you know, over 100 women and some men that she has mentored and really discipled in ministry. And she's had an incredible ministry doing that. And so I think there's always this fulfillment that women can have in doing that. And I think it is part of our uniqueness that we have this incredible capacity to nurture and to mentor. And so I really encourage women, whether it's your biological children or your spiritual children, invest in them, use that gifting that God has given you and flourish, build a kingdom.
And Julie, what do you hope that readers of your book, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, what do you hope that they're going to take away? You've obviously got women in mind, but women, that could be anywhere from a 15-year-old girl to an 88-year-old great-grandmother. It could be to someone active in a ministry schedule, to someone whose whole calling is homeschooling and raising a bunch of little kids. What's your hope, the major takeaways that women will get reading this book?
Well, it's been heartening to get feedback. You know, I just got an email this week from a woman, she's in her 20s, and she said she cried the whole way through the book because, one, she said, because I shared my frustrations and just my difficulty even navigating in the church, where I think sometimes there's misogyny there too and we don't recognize it. But she said, because you shared that, I was able to relate to that. But I also, the vision that you gave was something that I could really embrace. And she said, I felt like I embraced it on a deeper level than I ever had before. I know there's one woman who was older, and she's, you know, in her mid-50s, and she said she read the book, and she said, you know, Julie, my whole life I felt like this sadness over the time that I invested raising my children because I didn't have a career, and I felt like I should have. And she said, for the first time I realized I don't need that sadness. It's gone. I realized I did what God called me to do, and that's enough. And I've heard, interestingly, though, too, from men, Michael. And in fact, I go in and I'll do Redeeming the Feminine Soul conferences. And recently I met with some people at the church, and they're like, no, we don't want you just doing it for us. This was the women talking. We want you doing it for our husbands. And the pastor just talked to me because he's like, the men need to hear this because they don't understand. We don't understand how to bless women in ministry and how to really help them flourish. And so we do need to hear, and we don't understand even the ways, you know, I talk about the ways that we as women have embraced misogyny, you know, not loved the feminine in ourselves, but men too need to understand ways that they have done this. You know, we've all participated in, I think, some ways in this sin of not really valuing women and femininity in this aspect, really a characteristic of God has both feminine and masculine. We need to value them equally. And so I think there's both men and women, something to be gained from this book and just from understanding women better.
Oh, Julie, it is great talking about this subject, especially in today's climate, and recovering the biblical calling for men and for women. Thanks so much for joining me on the broadcast. Again, the book, Redeeming the Feminine Soul, Julie Royce. God bless you, Julie.
Thank you, Michael. God bless you, too.
All right. And friends, it is Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah tomorrow, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.